Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently.
Gave very interesting ideas, which I think are quite interesting on quite interesting because they're also they're not just very good analysis of Bitcoin, I think, but it's also new analysis which I hadn't heard before about how he thinks of valuing the Bitcoin network and why he thinks it's important. And one of the ideas he mentioned is that he's looked at internet networks over time, and it's common that a lot of people bring up MySpace, and Bitcoin is going to be the next MySpace because in their mind, you know, this is the example of the social network that disappeared. But he says, you know, MySpace at its peak was about a $1 billion company, which is 1/200 of what Bitcoin is right now. And what he says is there is this threshold effect that once a company, once an internet network is worth more than $100 billion, and once it's more than 10 times fold, once it's more than 10 times larger than its competitor, then there's no coming back. You know, these networks, they're not, they don't just disappear. They've established some level of sustainability and growth that's just going to continue. And so things like Apple and Google and Amazon, these are, and Facebook, these are the examples of these companies. Once you hit that kind of level, it becomes clear that you're dealing with a sustainable internet phenomenon. I guess I'm probably doing this concept not enough justice. So he does bring in some very interesting analysis on how they look at Bitcoin, and also just how they think of the value proposition of Bitcoin as hard money. And you know, a quite interesting thing that he said is that they're not looking at Bitcoin as a hedge and speculation. As I said, they're going on a Bitcoin standard, and he said, I'm holding this thing for 100 years. You know, they're not planning on going in and out quickly. They're thinking about it that this is something that is likely to be there for the long term. This is something that's going to continue to be there for many years, and we are going to hold it as a cash reserve in our balance sheet. And if you think about it, this is it sounds heretic. It sounded more heretic, I would say, last year. But if you just compare Bitcoin and other cash assets objectively, there is there's a huge room for more employment of Bitcoin in people's cash balances all over the world. I think this is what MicroStrategy shows us, and this is also what Paul Tudor Jones had discussed in his letter to investors, one of Wall Street's famous names, who announced that they took an investment in Bitcoin recently. He did the analysis on different assets to hold, and he looked at cash and gold, and basically concluded that, as he put it, the one thing that's different in this analysis, the one thing is wrong in this picture, and that is that Bitcoin is massively undervalued compared to where it could be, in terms of the potential demand that could emerge for an asset of this quality. And I think more and more people are beginning to discover it. And the interesting thing is that, you know, with the news of MicroStrategy, we're likely going to be seeing many more companies begin to ask themselves this question. As Michael Saylor says, we've got $5 trillion of corporate treasuries in publicly listed companies. And these $5 trillion are essentially, as he called them, melting ice cubes. People are holding them in currencies that are not going to be holding on to their value very well over the future. And he in particular, you know, he thinks about inflation in terms of the rise of asset prices. And so when you think about it that way, there's a very high opportunity cost to continuing to hold the US dollar. And it's becoming more and more of a problem for companies that have large cash balances. And I think MicroStrategy is offering an amazing solution for it. And it's absolutely fascinating what is going on. It'll be really incredibly interesting to see more about what he thinks about this. So look forward to joining him next week. Anybody want to say anything about this? Daniel, you had mentioned something earlier about the implication of this and on what MicroStrategy can do with workers.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that...
Daniel, I think you're muted. We can't hear you.
1, 2, 1, 2.
You know?
I can hear you.
1, 2. Can you hear me, guys?
Yeah. No. Yeah, I can hear you.
I can hear
everyone.
You.
How about now, Steve?
Oh, I think it's just my hello.
Yep. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you. Sorry, it was on my end.
Okay, cool. No problem. Yeah, we were, you know, like just discussing before that, you know, now that MicroStrategy have made this move, they are going to be way ahead in terms of other companies, and they're going to be in a position where they're going to be able to start attracting talent by paying, offering wages in Bitcoin. And some of the you know, that's just going to put them in a much better, a much stronger position to attract the leading talent in the space that want to be paid in Bitcoin. And that, you know, like we were discussing, it's just another level of the game theory playing out, another reason that is going to push other companies into this kind of corner of having to hold Bitcoin on their balance sheet as an option to pay wages to talent that want to come and work at that company. So I don't know if you have any further thoughts on that, but for me, it's just another way of hyper-Bitcoinization taking shape.
Yeah, I think that's it's a matter of time, I think, because the fact that more of their cash balance is in Bitcoin means that operationally now they can sell and buy some of that cash balance with quite easily, and so it's they're far more likely to be able to offer somebody to pay part of their salary in Bitcoin. Because now they have a big balance of Bitcoin as well as other currencies. And so it's, you know, we can see how this could play out in this regard, in that you get more and more, you know, as I say it repeatedly, it's first you build the cash balances in Bitcoin and then you start transacting with it. You can't, you're not going to transact with something that you don't have a cash balance in. And a lot of people have had this backwards idea of how Bitcoin adoption happens, in that people buy Bitcoin in order to then sell it for other goods and services. And then if, you know, if we all do that and use it to buy goods and services, we buy it and then we pay with it, then it takes off. And I think, that's not how it happened, because that's just adding an extra layer of inconvenience, where you say you get paid in dollars, then you buy Bitcoin, and then you sell the Bitcoin so that you can purchase things, or you pay the Bitcoin to other people so that they can purchase, give you stuff in exchange. But in this case, you're just adding an extra layer of complication, because a lot more people currently accept national currencies than they accept Bitcoin. And if you're getting paid in the national currency, and if you're going to be buying your groceries and paying your rent in the national currency, then converting in and out is going to just end up making you pay a lot of transaction fees. Now, because Bitcoin is useful as a money, because it's good to hold in your cash balance, because it holds on to its value, because it is better than holding national currencies for the majority of the people in the world, and basically for everybody in over the long time frame, over any kind of long time frame. It's always beaten every currency over anything longer than a 3-year time frame, I think. Because of that, you know, the value of cash balances that people can hold in Bitcoin are likely to rise over time. People who hold some Bitcoin will watch it appreciate. People who hold a lot of Bitcoin watch it appreciate a lot. And that makes them more likely to get more cash balances. Now, once people have more and more cash balances in Bitcoin, I think, that's when trade opportunities in Bitcoin begin to emerge in a way that saves them, that makes sense for both parties. And so once, you know, MicroStrategy has payments to make to other companies that also have Bitcoin on their balance sheet, then they can start making those payments in Bitcoin. And then it would make sense when both of them have Bitcoin balance sheets. But I think before that, to expect that you would get consumer payments before, I think really misses the point. And it's we can think about the market for monies almost as being a competition for cash balances. You know, the market share in the market for money is the share of cash balances that people have. And currently, you know, Bitcoin is at around 0.1 or 0.2, depends on how you calculate it. How what you consider as a cash balance, but you know, it's between 0.1 and 0.2, maybe 0.5 if you're going to be very strict about what you calculate, but it's still quite an insignificant part of the cash balances of the entire planet. But, you know, if it continues to appreciate, then it's likely to become a larger and larger part of these cash balances. Anybody else?
Just imagine as an employer setting the salary in bitcoins. Every single year you will have to go and negotiate with your employees to reduce their salary. The table will turn.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
That's true, actually. It's and if you think about it, it makes more sense that you would get paid less next year than you would be paid today, because present goods are worth more than future goods, if you remember. The whole point of the time preference, or the whole reason that we, or the result of having time preference, means that, or this is what time preference is, the fact that present goods are more valuable to us than future goods. That's why we have a time preference. And that's why it makes sense that you would pay somebody more today than you would pay them next year. It's a ridiculous construct that we have to pay people increasing sums of money next year. And it only happens because we've normalized the idea that money continuously devalues every year. But money shouldn't be devaluing. Even if it wasn't devaluing, you know, you would expect that, with devaluation, you would expect that nominal wages would continue to drop. And I, you know, Keynesians continue to think this is a disaster, but I think they're the only ones who don't get it. Everybody else would be quite happy with it because, you know, people care much more about what they can afford rather than the nominal number of units of money that they make. One interesting thing I wanted to ask him is if they're going to make Bitcoin a part of their business. I think it's they're a digital strategy company, and they've been it's quite interesting listening to him talk about the company history, about how much they've been around for quite a while, and through the internet years they were pioneers in buying domain names and so on, and it'll be interesting to see what direction they take with Bitcoin. Well, what are they going to be doing? Is that going to become a major part of their business? And how are they going to market it to other companies, or will they, or will they just keep it to themselves and just, you know, watch number go up like all the rest of us? It'll be quite interesting to see. Another interesting point that they brought up was the fact that they did not really buy or really look at or consider seriously buying any coins other than Bitcoin. It's the entire discussion was entirely about Bitcoin. I think that's quite telling, and I think it's worth remembering again just why Bitcoin is so different from all the other digital currencies, and why Bitcoin is so different from the shitcoins. I think it's worth revisiting this discussion. It's something that I've been known for on Twitter for quite a while. I was, I've been saying that all altcoins are scams for quite a while. Before most altcoins existed, I'd dismissed them as scams. And I think with time, I must say, I think my analysis is being more and more vindicated, particularly by things like MicroStrategy. Because for a company like them, what they're looking for is something that's much more dependable and reliable than just any of the shitcoins, really. And I think what distinguishes Bitcoin from the altcoins is ultimately the only thing that matters in Bitcoin. And that's specifically the aspect of immutability. For me, as I discuss in the Bitcoin Standard, and as I discuss in the course, the Bitcoin Standard, which you can find on safedean.com, for me, the entire economic value of Bitcoin comes from the fact that Bitcoin is scarce, that we know that Bitcoin is scarce, that Bitcoin can't just be produced out of thin air. And this is an enormously significant claim that Bitcoin makes. But it's not a claim that Bitcoin makes lightly. It's not easy to claim this thing. But Bitcoin has really, I think, made a reasonable claim for this after 10 years in which it's illustrated that it is, in fact, immutable. I think what a lot of the altcoins and shitcoins miss is that they don't have the credible commitment to the fact that the supply is scarce and immutable. And the supply can be changed trivially in all of the altcoins. And for me, this isn't just, a feature difference. This isn't just a difference in feature, as some shitcoiners would like to tell. Well, our shitcoin is not trying to be sound money, so it doesn't matter whether our supply is fixed or not, or it doesn't matter how many of our coin are there. No, it's not about whether you're trying to be sound money or not. It's about whether you can actually be valued as a good or not. If you remember, in Economics 11, or Principles of Economics 1, in the first lecture, we discussed the concept of value. And we say that, economic value comes from scarcity. The only reason that we assign value to things is because they're scarce. So something like air is necessary. It has utility for us. We would die without air. But it's not scarce, and so therefore we don't have economic value attached to air. Anything that's not scarce doesn't have economic value. If you were living next to a river of fresh water, then you would not have economic value on the next marginal unit of fresh water, because it's not scarce. You can just get any quantity that you want from it. So scarcity is really what is essential for making something have any kind of economic value. And with Bitcoin, the idea that Bitcoin managed to introduce scarcity to the digital realm is an enormously, enormously complicated claim that's not easy to understand and not easy to verify. Well, relatively, it is easy to verify compared to all the other monies. But it's still not easy to understand the claim that Bitcoin makes, the fact that Bitcoin really is digitally scarce, and the fact that there's no way of making more Bitcoins except through abiding by the rules of the protocol, which ensure that there's only going to be 21 million coins. That's something that no coin other than Bitcoin can demonstrate. And for me, if they can't demonstrate that, then they cannot really claim to have the only thing that matters in Bitcoin. And then for anything else that they claim to have, you know, ultimately, everything that they claim to do is better done with a centralized system. The only thing that you need a decentralized system for is to have digital scarcity enforced. That's really the only thing that Bitcoin does. Bitcoin uses this extremely sophisticated network structure on this extremely complicated blockchain structure in order to make Bitcoin decentralized, in order to make Bitcoin resistant to attack, and in order to make Bitcoin's money supply fixed. Because of that, we've never managed to find anybody who found a way of cracking Bitcoin's consensus rules. We've never broken consensus, and everybody who's dealt with Bitcoin has dealt with Bitcoin according to consensus rules at every single block height. And that's why we've stuck by the monetary supply as we have. Now, which other coin can make that claim? None, because in Bitcoin's case, you know, we know this has happened after 10 years of Bitcoin operating. Most of those years, Bitcoin operated without the person who invented it being there. You know, they disappeared at a certain point, and the coins continued to work. You know, Bitcoin continued to operate, even though the person behind it wasn't there. It continued to operate as a neutral internet protocol, even though there was no central agency behind it. There was no company. There was no startup behind it. There was no CEO, and yet it continued to work. Since that has happened, there's not a single digital currency that has done the same thing. All the digital currencies have a small group of people that are behind them that are actively promoting them. And they have a small group of people that can quite easily change the consensus rules. And this has really, you know, the more you look at digital currencies, the more you see that this is, you know, the more prominent the digital currency, the more successful it is, the more centralized it really is in reality, other than Bitcoin, of course. Because once you've already had Bitcoin operating, once you've already had this network operating and this amount of security that was existing, then there's not going to be spontaneous and real market demand for a new network that is infant, that doesn't have security, that doesn't have liquidity. It's not going to emerge spontaneously, and it's not going to be a secure network unless there's a group of people who are able to code it and take care of it and mine it and advertise it and promote it during its infancy. In other words, the only way that a digital currency can grow after Bitcoin was already invented was for the digital currencies to have a centralized team behind them. And so with time, the only ones that succeeded are the ones that have a small team behind them. And if you have a small team behind you, it's trivial to change the consensus parameters, and it's trivial to change the supply. And if it's trivial to change the supply, then, you know, I think the value proposition in my mind just does not exist in the long term. In the short term, you can keep the supply stable enough that people can have trust in it and people can trade it, and, you know, it can be used as a small sort of gambling market, in a sense, and a little Ponzi scheme. But it's in the long term, and as we saw with the second biggest digital currency, Ethereum, in the long term, what ends up happening is that, you know, you're going to get political problems around these questions, and it's going to inevitably turn out that there are some people in charge and that those people can decide the rules of the network. And so we saw this when the Ethereum network did a hard fork because somebody had hacked one of their, well, they didn't even hack it. They used one of their contracts. They used an exploit in the contract, in one of their smart contracts, which is a wonderful Orwellian term. It was a contract that was so smart that it cost them $150 million. But, you know, the network is so immutable that they basically rolled it back and prevented and canceled the effectively the exploit that the guy had used, even though he had abided by the rules of the network. So with this, there's really none of them. If the second largest network can be hard forked this trivially, then you know that the consensus parameters can be changed very easily. Then you know that the supply can be changed. And for me, if that's the case, then, you know, you cannot imagine that anybody would, you know, anybody who would do serious due diligence would put serious resources into these kinds of silly high school projects that essentially pretend play decentralization in order to be able to effectively sell gambling tokens on markets without being personally liable for them. But in reality, they are just centralized projects controlled by small teams. And so if these things are meant to compete with Bitcoin, they can't compete with Bitcoin because, you know, we're going to see that, their supply, we see that their supply is essentially whatever the guys in charge decide it is going to be. And then on all these other things that they pretend to be competing on, you know, that we're going to be a platform for, you know, something or the other, all of that stuff might well, you know, to the extent that they do have actual business cases that they are working on, all of that stuff is in fact competing with AWS, with Amazon Web Services, really. They're not competing with Bitcoin. They're competing with centralized providers of cloud computing solutions. And currently, you know, the difference in cost is not even comparable. Like trying to get a smart contract or trying to get an app to run on one of the one of these smart contract shitcoin platforms is many hundreds of thousands of times more expensive than trying to get it to run on AWS. And with AWS, you get, you know, good customer service. And, you know, AWS is much more efficient because it is centralized and these things don't need decentralization. The only thing that needs decentralization so far, I think, is clear, is just the maintenance of the censorship resistance and the monetary policy of a currency. But none of these coins can credibly claim to provide that. And so then they pretend that they're using this decentralization in order to provide all these kinds of other uses, you know, cloud computing effectively and smart contracts and all these silly buzzwords that they march out. But none of that requires decentralization. You don't need a social media. You can't, you know, you're not going to run your, you're not going to run a Facebook alternative on a blockchain. It's just not going to be faster. It's just going to be much, 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 much slower. And so for me, if these currencies were fully centralized and trying to compete with Bitcoin, they would be far more interesting. Of course, the problem then is if they were fully centralized, you know, they wouldn't be, it would be harder legally for them to compete with Bitcoin because then there'd be somebody to shut them down. But they are effectively centralized. And, you know, if push comes to shove, and there are people that can be influenced. There are single points of failure in these scam coins. There are people that can change the code. Very few people run nodes in these networks. Very, very few people can afford to run nodes in Ethereum, for instance. And so the consensus rules are really determined by a few companies and a few individuals, and they can be altered. And in fact, you know, in terms of the money supply for Ethereum, it's up in the air. You know, they themselves say, well, we're going to let the community decide what we're going to be doing with it, and we're not sure what we're going to be doing. So it's essentially back to being a political question. And that means that we don't have digital scarcity. That means that, you know, the digital scarcity in all of these networks is essentially transient. It's nowhere near as reliable as Bitcoin is. And so in the long run, I can't really see this as being anywhere near as reliable as Bitcoin would be in the long run. And that's why I think, you know, yes, you get some of these silly hedge funds investing money in stupid shit coins, and mainly they're doing it as a way of dumping. You know, like you see the hedge fund bros on Twitter thought leadering about the stupid new shit coins that they're launching and how, you know, this is going to disrupt this and this and that. And of course, you know, they're financing the early stage of the shit coin. And they get a bunch of programmers, and they create the buzz around it, and then they start dumping the coins, and the price crashes. We've had years and years of all of these new stupid scams coming along with all kinds of new stupid buzzwords, and then you know, the early promoters of the coins make money, and then the coin slips into oblivion over time. And I think This is the natural end state for this, because there's no use case for this kind of form of centralized currency that pretends to be decentralized, that you know, doesn't do the only thing that Bitcoin can do, which is be digitally scarce and have an immutable monetary policy. It cannot do that. And then it uses that structure to try and pretend to be doing all kinds of other silly rituals that have nothing to do with it, and that can't really be done with a blockchain. And as I discussed this in my book, in the final chapter of the Bitcoin Standard, I discuss just how useless blockchain technology is for everything else. And here we are. It's been now 6-7 years that we've had people talk about the wonderful transformative potential of blockchain technology. And we see with the MicroStrategy news, the only business use case that has been successfully implemented by anybody anywhere in the past 6-7 years on business on blockchain technology is the use of Bitcoin as a cash asset, is the use of Bitcoin as hard money. You know, if you think about it, it's really now this MicroStrategy news really puts into perspective all the stupid bank consortium and alliances that they were doing in 2015, 16, and 17 to look at, to build blockchain technology. How much money was wasted on, you know, vaporware, essentially. All of these companies that have produced essentially nothing. They've just produced vaporware over the past 5-6 years and press releases. Imagine if all of that money was used to accumulate Bitcoin, how different the balance sheets of those companies would look today. If they and you know, some of them were doing this when Bitcoin was at $300. And you know, they spent tens of millions of dollars researching the applications of blockchain technology, when all they could have done, when, you know, the only application was to spend those dollars on actually acquiring actual Bitcoins.
Yeah, going back to MicroStrategy again, I found it pretty interesting that there was a few people in here that after the announcement was made, some of us now are entering back into the Wild West of the stock market, just purely on the back of this news. I'd like to get your thoughts on that, and whether you're going to see millions more people doing the same thing as a way to diversify their Bitcoin holdings, essentially. That's the way I'm looking at it anyway.
Yeah, I think it's, I'm not sure as much the demand is going to be that it's Bitcoiners diversifying their Bitcoin holding by buying MicroStrategy as much as it is stockholders diversifying their stock holdings by buying Bitcoin exposed companies. Because now, you know, you can effectively with MicroStrategy, you can get exposure to Bitcoin on the NASDAQ because you can just buy MicroStrategy. So that puts them in a unique position where an enormous pool of capital can access them because they can buy stocks. And also makes them, you know, so that's going to be good for their stock, likely. And the stock has done essentially really well. I think it's up 60% since the first announcement of holding Bitcoin cash balances. So that's a pretty significant rise over the last, month or 2 months? I'm not sure about the numbers. Somebody can check how much they've gone up since then. It would be useful. But yeah, so the stock will do well. And I think at this point, remember what we've discussed earlier, in that you can think of buying Bitcoin at this point as being like an investment in a startup central bank. It's like the Uber of central banks, and you're getting to invest in the Uber of central banks at the seed stage, because anybody can invest in it, because the way that you invest in it is that you hold the coins. You don't make dividends, but the coins appreciate. That's effectively the investment. It's not really an investment because there's no dividends, but functionally you can think about it that way, that when you're buying Bitcoin right now, you're not just buying Bitcoin because, you know, you're using it as an asset on your balance sheet. You're also buying Bitcoin because you're thinking about the fact that the supply is limited and demand is potentially much larger. And if demand increases over time, then this is just going to be much more valuable. So effectively, Bitcoin is like a speculative bet on this new, buying Bitcoin is like a speculative bet on this new monetary asset. And it's what Pierre Rochard calls a growth currency. It's a currency that can grow. Hello, welcome to the fourth Bitcoin Standard Seminar podcast. I'm Dr. Saifedean Al-Mous, and I'm here with... And then we move on to the assembly line.
It'll be... one way I like to think about it, that it might just be that there's just no better investment in the world right now than putting central banks out of business. If you think about it, if you think about just how much bad things central banks have done in the world over the last century, the market really is pricing in the how much more efficient and more productive the world would be under a Bitcoin standard than if we would be under a central bank standard. And so the increase in the price of Bitcoin is kind of like a symptom of that, in that is just the reevaluation of the Bitcoin economy, because the Bitcoin economy is low inflation, and because the Bitcoin economy is allows for much faster international settlement of payments. It's just a superior system, and if you believe that it is a superior system, you buy Bitcoin early and then Bitcoin appreciates. If you think it's an inferior system, you don't buy Bitcoin. You keep your money in the central bank system and you watch it either appreciate or depreciate. So in a sense, buying Bitcoin at this point is a speculative, it's an investment and an entrepreneurial call. And, you know, it is speculative, and I don't say that as a bad word. Speculative is not a bad word. All economic activity is speculative. Now it's interesting because maybe more companies start doing this, and maybe this becomes a very successful strategy for pumping stock market numbers up. Maybe, you know, this becomes the way that large companies manage to get high returns on their stocks, which is hold significant amount of Bitcoin, invest in the
invest in the startup that is disrupting central banks and give your shareholders a lot of money. And really, if you think about it, I think central banks themselves might be convinced that this is a good solution in a sense, because, you know, what is propping up the stock markets and what is propping up everybody's retirement account and what is propping up the housing market and what is propping up everything so far is the Fed's quantitative easing and the Fed's monetary easing and the Fed's infinite QE, basically. And, you know, I don't think central banks are exactly excited about the prospect of waking up every morning and handing over more billions of dollars to financial institutions as people continue to get angrier and angrier about inequality. And if Bitcoin is going to pump the bags of the stock market, you know, I don't see why the central bankers would not like that, you know. If more MicroStrategies comes along and then they start all pumping their bags by getting their stocks to appreciate by holding Bitcoin, well, then, you know, the central banks can relax. Swiss central bank doesn't need to keep buying Apple and Tesla stock. All the world's central banks can stop giving them QE. And instead, you know, all these companies just buy more and more Bitcoin and the price of Bitcoin continues to appreciate. It's a new angle that you can think about, actually, that I could add to the scenario I mentioned in my research paper on Bitcoin adoption, in one of these papers that I sent to the subscribers, of Bitcoin being an upgrade. You know, Bitcoin cancels debt. Bitcoin allows us to monetize something other than debt. The current monetary system is monetizing debt, and as a result, it constantly needs the central bank to keep issuing more and more and more debt in order for the monetary system to continue to operate. Bitcoin has a different model where we don't need debt. We just have a hard asset, and so the hard asset appreciates rather than needing an ever-growing number of suckers to continue to buy the debt. So maybe this is what we need. Maybe this is the fix, and this is really how I think of this in and this is going to be really the topic of the fiat standard, my next book. It's essentially that Bitcoin fixes the fiat standard by allowing us to stop monetizing debt. For the past 100 years, we've been monetizing debt, and we can think of the world around us as in the same way that the Yap Island, which I discussed in the Bitcoin standard, they monetized all these giant limestones. Because they used limestones as money, they kept on producing more and more limestones to the point when we got to the point where they needed these massive rocks as money. And so, you know, we're constantly incentivized to make more of whatever is being used as money. And gold is the best solution to that problem. Bitcoin is an even better solution to that problem now. But the fiat standard meant that the entire world was constantly making more debt, because every time you're making more debt, you're effectively creating new money. And so institutions that can issue debt, regulated institutions that are given license to issue debt by their local central bank, effectively are like gold miners in a fiat standard. They're like Bitcoin miners. They make new fiat. They create new money. So financial institutions create money into existence when they create new loans. And that, in my mind, when you think of my analysis of how there's always an incentive for making more money in the Bitcoin standard, you can apply that to the fiat standard. There's always an incentive for making more fiat. And so there's always an incentive to get people into more debt. And that's why everybody and everything is in debt. You know, individuals are in debt, corporations are in debt, governments are in debt. Everybody is borrowing from everybody else. And everybody is up to their eyeballs in debt, because it's very profitable for people to give you debt. And so it's, you know, you get a good deal if you, you know, it's more profitable for you to get into debt for your house, because when you get into debt for your house, your bank is able to print a whole bunch of new money for you, because they create new money every time they issue out a mortgage. So you're essentially getting a discount on your house because the bank can afford to give you a discount by because the bank is because the bank is effectively making some money through money creation. You know, they're effectively, every time they issue a mortgage for you, it's like they're mining gold in a gold standard because they're making new debt. It's not just that they're taking other people's money and giving it to you as debt. They create new debt. And so Bitcoin fixes this. And maybe this is one way in which it fixes it. Stocks. I mean, Bitcoin fixes this in general in that we now can monetize a hard asset. And so if we continue to monetize a hard asset, the hard asset appreciates and we don't need to make more debt. And so maybe over time, more and more people hold more and more debt. More and more people hold more Bitcoin, demand for debt instruments, demand for treasuries, demand for mortgages, demand for all kinds of borrowing declines. And people use hard asset as their money rather than continuing to use more and more debt. And so maybe this is the way that we get out of it. And in the case of corporate treasuries, maybe the Trojan horse that we gets us in is the fact that Bitcoin will start pumping the stock market without QE. Maybe Bitcoin replaces QE, and then the central banks can just they can take a break from printing money, and the stock market will continue to pump because the stock market will just be holding Bitcoin. So there's the research papers that I wrote to subscribers about a year and a half ago, which are going to make the basis of my Bitcoin Standard book. They're on my website on saveddean.com/research. This one, I think, is in the, it's in Bitcoin monetization scenario. It's the second one. So it's the research bulletin number 2. And it's on Bitcoin monetization scenarios and how we can think about Bitcoin as being the solution to the global debt problem. We no longer need to get everybody into debt. All right. Well, I guess this is it for today. Thank you everybody for joining, and please don't forget to join us next week, same time and same place, where we will be joined by Michael Saylor himself to discuss Bitcoin and what he plans in doing with it for the next 100 years. All right. See you next week. Bye-bye.
To get a 5% discount.
Safety to Moose. How's everything going these days?
Things are good, Jimmy. Things are going very well. I'm books that I've been working on for a while now. Principles of Economics, a textbook on economics, and the Fiat Standard, which is the sequel to the Bitcoin Standard. So these are taking up most of my time.
Like a true academic. And speaking of which, you've been in academia for quite a while. Can you tell us the story of how you got into it and what led you to that road?
Well, I was, I think, 3 years old when my parents marched me into kindergarten, and I only managed to extricate myself out of that vicious cycle of dependency on the academic system last year when I quit my job as a university professor. I basically went from kindergarten to school, university, back to working at the university up until last year when I quit my job as a university professor and became essentially an independent entrepreneur, teaching economics on my own website to students from all over the world and focusing on my own writing and research. I've developed a lot of misgivings about the educational system, as you and I have discussed, and readers who are familiar with my book will identify the connection here is that I can see the impact of fake money on academia, on easy money, money that is produced at a low opportunity cost or at a zero opportunity cost almost, is quite corrupting of the process of academic inquiry. It's quite disillusioning, and the outcomes of the process are quite mediocre because of that, mediocre to start off being flattering at least.
Yeah, you're getting into some of the problems with college education. But before we get into that, why do you think people get into a college education? Because as far as I can tell, there's a glut of supply. There's so many people that want to be professors, almost no jobs. So what's going on there? Why is there this imbalance?
I think ultimately the root cause of the imbalance is government intervention in the academic system. And of course, this is almost sounds like it's a caricature response, but you know, it also happens to be true in all of these cases. When you prevent producers and consumers of products from interacting freely with one another, you develop all these artificial rules and restrictions and all these interventions in wherein taxpayer money or fiat money is used to make market decisions effectively in the hands of the people who are able to command money that they haven't worked for, then you're distorting the institution from working toward the people that is supposedly intended to serve and turning it into an institution that works more to serve the people that are financing it with the low opportunity cost money.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of money in academia. I think I heard like third party payers or, you know, student loan givers like essentially set the agenda in many ways. Can you talk a little bit more about that and many other problems with college education today? What is wrong with the mission that they originally had versus what students are getting now?
Well, I guess let's just focus a little bit perhaps on the way in which the incentives are corrupted, perhaps. Then we can discuss the consequences of it, because I think identifying, contrary to Keynesian belief, to Keynesians and Keynes, who used to think it's not important to understand the causes of things, it's important to understand the solutions. I'm one of these old-fashioned people who thinks causes matter. The ultimate distortion in this case, to go back to your original question, is that there's an enormous amount of government subsidy given for college education. And, we can, at some point, there are all kinds of different sociological explanations and cultural explanations of why it is that government wants to subsidize this thing. But putting all of that aside, thinking from the economics of it, we have to understand that once you're making it so that loans in the college industry are cheaper to acquire and easier to acquire, then you're distorting people's incentives. So if your ability to borrow to start a business is difficult, but your ability to borrow to go and get a college degree is much easier, this is distorting your economic calculation. You know, you're constantly trying to get price signals from the market. You never have full knowledge and full information of what is going on. You're always trying to, you know, make the most out of the knowledge that is available for you. When these prices are distorted by effectively by the ability of fiat money to enter these markets and distort capital allocation, then it distorts people's incentives. And so more and more people are likely to consider college when getting a loan for college is almost like a birthright, you know? And well, not exactly, but I mean, it's easier than other things. Although the notion of making college debt a birthright is popular in some areas, I would say. But effectively, it is, as you and I think would agree, it is effectively a form of being born into slavery because you're getting everybody into debt for college. There's always an opportunity cost. I think that's really the key thing. There is always an opportunity cost to it. And distorting prices and distorting incentives manipulates people's calculations and leads to them making erroneous calculations. And that's, we see it in every market. And I see no reason why this would not happen in the education market and in capital markets in general.
Yeah. And we've seen the growth of colleges. Most of them charge way more money than they used to. And in large part because these loans are available. What do you think that does to the actual education experience of the student?
One way to look at it is that when you're creating a bureaucratic incentive for one of those things, it sounds like a nice ideal. You know, let's finance this thing with credit money and then we'll have more of it. You know, let's finance more college or more hospitals or more healthcare and then we'll get more of it. But really what you're doing is that you're manipulating people's economic calculation.
This is definitely true that a lot of colleges are able to spend a lot more money because of the existence of these student loans. We've seen in the past 20, 30 years how college tuition has gone up tremendously and they're able to get a tremendous amount of capital allocation, you know, probably not in proportion to the value that they're actually providing. So how does that affect the student experience? How does that, you know, change the incentives for the students?
What ends up happening when you subsidize any kind of business, it starts off with the nice intentions that, you know, we'd get more college, we'd get more college degrees, and so therefore we'd have better qualified labor force and higher productivity and better income. But in reality, once you've made it so that it is a government objective for money to be spent in this regard, then you've created a source of income that is free from market competition. You've created a bunch of jobs where people can get a salary without having to satisfy customers. And you've created incentives for people to take on specific jobs that do not produce value for consumer, but they are able to secure for the funding from the funders. And so I think you see this happening in bureaucracies all over, and it is outlined by academic economists from universities who apply this framework to the study of industries all over the world and to cartels all over the world, but hesitate somehow, for understandable reasons, to apply it to their own profession because, you know, their salary is dependent on it. What ends up happening in this situation is that it's possible for a bureaucracy to emerge in these institutions whose focus is on continuing to do what is required politically, both in the sense of domestic politics as well as in the sense of the running of the organization itself, rather than satisfying the consumers. You know, you've established a group of jobs that are detached from the bottom line, in a sense, and that have different incentives, because it's not about securing the students in as much as it is securing the low interest rate loans. And so I think if you look throughout the years, what is happening is that we're getting a massive increase in the tuition. There's also a massive increase in the number of degrees and in the number of universities. And so you would expect that because we're getting so many more universities, that prices would be dropping. You know, in the same way we have many more TVs and laptops, we're always making more stuff. And so the new stuff continues to get cheaper over time as it gets older. You would expect that with universities, with so many universities out there, that you would get a competition that brings down the supply, that you would have a lot more education going on and at a lower price. But instead, what we find is the price continues to go up. Part of that, as we said, is because of the availability of low credit. But also, if you look at the expenses, you see that the majority of the increase in spending in universities has gone toward administrative roles. And so the growing politicization of the university and the growing need for just a large institutional apparatus in order to make the university continue to run ends up becoming just an increase in bureaucratic bloat of people who are dependent on these jobs, and they don't necessarily add much value. One idea that keeps coming to me is that why is it that we've not really seen proper entrepreneurship in university setting emerge? Like, we haven't seen a Steve Jobs of universities. We haven't seen university administrators who have managed to get their university to issue great degrees at a cheaper price, or, you know, making these enormous improvements. We just see growing increase in price and effectively a setting where bureaucratically and organizationally the power in the university structure is becoming more and more in the hands of the bureaucracy. And the operation of the university is more about the bureaucracy rather than the professors or the students. And I think, you know, the exciting thing about the internet is that it fixes this.
Well, so a question for you about these college administrators, which by every metric, they've been growing like gangbusters at every college. Why is it that when there is a lot more funds, like that tends to be the case, that you get a lot more administrators in any sort of organization? I know this is true for colleges like we've been talking about, but it's also true of government, of healthcare, of a lot of different things. It seems like they almost always kind of show up somehow whenever